Well, here we are, ladies and gentlemen, another episode of the Secular Foxhole Podcast, and we've been eagerly anticipating appearance of our guest. Andrew Sedell is the Director of Strategic Response at the Freedom from Religion Foundation. Andrew, how are you?
I am doing well. Thank you so much for having me back on, gentlemen.
Well, it's our pleasure. And today we want to discuss Andrew's book, which is The Founding Myth, Why Christian Nationalism is Un-American. Andy, can you tell us briefly why you wrote the book? And then I think Martin wants to ask you something.
Sure. I wanted to explore the idea, do we have a government of the people, for the people, and by the people? Or is ours a government of the Christians and for the Christians and by the Christians? Because that is the battle that we are having. Right now, America is in a desperate fight against Christian nationalism. It's this political theology that is an existential threat to our republic. So that's why I wrote The Founding Myth. You know, it's not often that you write a book and give it a subtitle that's as inflammatory as mine is, Why Christian Nationalism is Un-American. And then the subject like runs out to prove you right on January 6th. It was terrible, but also kind of nice in a way.
Well,
all right. it was a weird situation. I literally said this to a room of 250 religion reporters about 5 months after the book came out. I used those words, Christian nationalism is an existential threat to our republic. And then to have them attack the beating heart of our democracy, you know, a few months later, it was mind blowing to see. It was somehow exactly what I was expected, and then so shocking at the same time.
Talk Go ahead, about Martin. Shocking, Drew. I see on your Twitter account, you have a pinned tweet there. May I read from that?
Please
the
do.
Preacher filmed himself burning a book I put 8 years of work into, The Founding Myth, Why Christian Nationalism is Un-American. You could get a copy here and then a link. And that's the quote from your tweet. And then I searched on him on Google and found this. In 2009, conservative evangelical pastor Greg, and the surname is pretty interesting, Locke, engaged in a book burning of a copy of a book which Seidel has sent to Locke, etc. So that will include in the show notes. But what have happened since then? And as we know, freedom of speech is, of course, to burn books also, all kinds of included, even if it could be offensive. But he was not even thinking of reading it.
No.
Maybe turn back on him in some way, that people wanted to buy the book or so on. So could you tell about what's happened since then?
Sure. It was such a bizarre feeling to see somebody not just burn your book, but film themselves burning your book and, you know, kind of make it all about this pageantry. He overlaid music to it. He did it with a blowtorch. You know, this was theater. And we all know what book burning, those images from history all come back. We all know the famous quotes, and it's hard not to shake those. And then to also know how much work that I put into this and how careful I was with the 1,000+ citations in the book and how many early mornings I spent getting up at 5 a.m. and writing. It was awful to see. It was also very just a strange, surreal moment. And then I got massive support from people. Oh, if this person is burning the book, then that's a book I want to read. So it certainly did backfire, at least in that sense. There's something called the Streisand effect. Inadvertently call attention to something you don't want to call attention to by trying to oppose it. And he did that, and I got a lot of great support from it. Since then, I feel again like the book has been proven more and more correct. And Locke himself has also been proving it correct. You know, Locke went to D.C. and was there on the evening of January 5th. He was at a prayer rally. He took the place of Enrique Tarrio, who is one of the founders or leaders of the Proud Boys. And he said a prayer for one of the Proud Boys at that rally, saying, we're thrilled to be able to lock shields with them. And just this really militant Christian nationalist sermon and prayer. And then the next day you have this just explosion of violence done in the name of Christian nationalism, really. So, I mean, since then, he's kind of, in a way, a poster child for everything the book is trying to to push back against.
Right. Well, let's explore the book. Now, my understanding of history and of the founding era is that most, if not all of the founders, deists. And what is deism? Because this is all but unknown today, I think.
Yeah, I mean, deism is essentially the belief that there was a creator God that set existence going and kind of left it at that. Not a God necessarily that intervenes in human affairs, certainly not that intervenes in human affairs in response to human prayers. And this is a really fascinating debate. And I could, you know, if we were able to do this in person, we were out at a bar and you were to give me a glass of whiskey, you know, I could do this for six or eight hours. I could have this debate. But really what I try to talk about in the founding myth is that when you're thinking about whether or not America was founded as a Christian nation, the personal religious beliefs of the founding fathers don't really matter. And when you engage in that debate as a proxy for whether or not they founded a Christian nation, you're already ceding so much ground. You're giving away a lot of the argument. And I mean, there's a couple of reasons for this. One is people's beliefs change over their lifetime, right? Like I don't believe the same thing now that I did when I was, 27 or 17 or 7. And the same would certainly hold for George Washington and John Adams. And then they also were politicians, and they said different things publicly than they did privately. They had political opinions and political speech, and then they had their private opinions and private speech. And you can find and mine quotes to support virtually any position that you want to take. But if you're talking about whether or not they founded the United States as a Christian nation, we've got a ton of evidence showing that they absolutely did not do that. So let's focus on that. So this is one of the things that I jump in right at the beginning of the book. You know, the first couple of chapters are about this. But really, the central argument I'm trying to make for people is this is super fascinating and fun. But let's talk about like the fact that they left God out of the Constitution entirely, and that the only mentions of religion in that entire document are exclusionary to keep religion out of government. That's far more telling about their views on the relationship between religion and the law and religion and government than their personal religious beliefs, whatever they may have been.
It's good to hear you fired up already here. Whiskey or not. How is it to feel to sit, because you are working with this on a daily basis, to sit on the wall separating church and state, or as I always also say, religion and state? Mm-hmm. Because in the future, it may be not national Christians, it could be militant Muslims that want to change something. How do you see that? How is the battle going? And then Blair will continue with the book here. Because I think, I said that in the green room, everyone should read that is in power. And then they should detract and they will do something about this. And then we could talk about, is that any... you know, active that are not saying, or is that then, you know, no? Will you get burned if you're saying that you're not so-called believer?
I mean, I'll go in reverse order on that. Yeah. I mean, we're seeing more acceptance broadly, socially and politically in the United States for atheists and non-religious people generally. For instance, to give you just kind of one marker, a few years ago, members of Congress formed the Congressional Freethought Caucus, which is not dedicated to atheism, but is dedicated to upholding the separation of state and church, to science-based policy, and that has been growing. Representative Jared Huffman and then Jamie Raskin, who led the second impeachment fight. It's amazing that you have to say second impeachment. You have to qualify impeachment when you're talking about Trump's impeachments. Anyway, Jamie Raskin and Jared McNerney, Jared Huffman and McNerney were co-founders of that. And it's grown quite a bit since then, and it's still growing. I mean, so that's one really good indicator. And then at the state level, we're seeing even more growth and more willingness to be open about a lack of belief. We just had numbers this morning showing that non-religious Americans, the nones, N-O-N-E-S, make up 25% of the electorate. And that number has been growing and growing and growing, meaning that it is going to not just not pay dividends to pander to religious sensibilities as a politician, but could become a liability because those numbers are going up and up and up. And that's really a good way to change things is to grow your political power. So I think we are seeing things change on that front. That being said, the legal fight to uphold and defend the wall of separation between state and church is not going well. The Supreme Court is hostile to the idea that state and church should be separate and has been working desperately to weaponize religious freedom and elevate that right above every other right, including the rights of third parties to be free from discrimination, for instance. I'm so actually blown away by how radical and extreme this Supreme Court is that's the next book that I am currently working on. It's the working title is called Weaponizing Religious Freedom. It'll be out sometime next year.
Good.
And it's about this drive and a lot of the court's recent decisions and how poorly they've been reported on in the media and how the court itself has twisted the facts to reach conclusions and reverse engineer decisions so that they favor Christian Americans.
And Andrew, and you'll get going, but for international listeners,
sure.
Could you explain how important this with the court system is? You know, this three part, you could say, system that you have. In a way, if it's good, it's balance. But when you hear this, it's almost what you see in other countries. You could say Iran or others, but they try to, you know, push certain
views yes.
into yeah. the legal system. And like, for example, I said, militant Muslims. They maybe in the future want to have Sharia laws. In Europe, you have these tendencies that forces want to do that.
Sure.
And,
I mean,
maybe you, when maybe one day you wake up and say, oops, something have happened. And we are all for personal beliefs, of course. But if some people would be in power, we will not be able to have our beliefs, right?
So. Yeah, I mean, that's the problem. What you're seeing the court doing and the goal of Christian nationalism, too, is to elevate American Christians to a special privileged class so that everybody else is second class citizens. That is really the goal. That is why I say that Christian nationalism is not this scholarly debate. It's a sinister exclusionary movement. The goal is to redefine America according to the Christian nationalist identity and then to reshape the law accordingly. And it does that by claiming that we are a Christian nation. By claiming that we are founded on Judeo-Christian principles, and most importantly, that we've strayed from that foundation, that we've gotten away from our godly roots. And they use that language of return then to justify public policy, or in the case of the Supreme Court, to justify these awful decisions. And so, I mean, that's why I wrote The Founding Myth, to completely and utterly destroy the myths and lies that justify the Christian nationalist rhetoric and identity, to undo those historical myths and the cover they try to give. Did you want me? Did you say you wanted me to do like a brief explanation of the? Okay, so in the American system, you have the president and Congress. President is the executive. Congress is the legislature. They make the laws. The president enforces the laws. And then you have the Supreme Court, which heads up the judiciary branch, and they are meant to interpret the laws, including the Constitution. And when they work, they're supposed to balance each other out. Unfortunately, the Supreme Court was packed by Donald Trump and Mitch McConnell with Christian nationalists. So it is a completely partisan body right now. It is no longer...
They will stay there until they die, or how is it?
They have lifetime appointments, and they are not impartial arbiters of justice. This is a court dedicated to one political party and really to one religion and enforcing beliefs of that party and religion. And this is not just me being hyperbolic. I mean, there are studies backing this up. So for instance, there's a recent study published here looking at religious freedom cases going back 80 years. And most of the time throughout our history, you see what you would expect to see. If you don't know anything about the law, you'd say, well, I would expect people who are religious and litigating cases all the way to the Supreme Court to win about half the time. And that's what you see. They win about 58% of the time, so a little more than half. But when you get to this most recent court, to the current Chief Justice John Roberts, who took the bench in 2005, followed immediately by another very conservative justice, and then, as we know, Donald Trump forced 3 Supreme Court justices onto the court. Now that number is up over 80% of the cases are being decided in favor of the religious claimants in the cases, and specifically the Christian claimants. So the court, I mean, there's no doubt about it, the court has tipped extremely into the pro-Christian column here, which is not what you are supposed to be seeing at all.
I see ominous parallels to Iran. You know, there you have the mullahs behind the scenes. They have a president, so-called, that they are rigged election, but the one that are really deciding, it's the mullahs that decide everything. I mean, it's not the same thing in United States of America, but the ominous parallels is not going in the right direction. So please continue. And at the end of this show, we have to have a positive note. Otherwise,
I mean, we are right. We are slouching toward theocracy, right? I mean, that is part of the problem. On a positive note, I will say this, that the identity of the Christian nationalist depends on certain myths and lies. Mm. And it is things like we are one nation under God and in God we trust, or that the Declaration of Independence references the Christian God 4 different times, or that all the founding fathers were evangelical Christians, or that they prayed at the Constitutional Convention, or that George Washington knelt in the snow at Valley Forge and prayed, or that our laws are based on the 10 Commandments. And really, without the historical cover that those lies give, their policy justifications begin to crumble. So without that commonwealth of myths, their identity begins to actually wither and fade. So the good news is that their entire political and ideological reality is incredibly weak and vulnerable because it's based on disinformation, because it's based on historical distortions and lies. But we need more, and this is such a sad thing to say in the middle of my happy years of Ms. Shaila. We need more than facts to fight back. We need better arguments. And so that is really what I am trying to do in the founding myth, is to give everyone the arguments that work in addition to the facts that are true to bury Christian nationalism. So it's a simple goal. It's a lofty goal. But I set out to utterly destroy this un-American political ideology.
I see. Again,
best premises with that. So Blair, please continue.
Thank you, Martin. Thank you. You argue that the term Judeo-Christian is a made-up formulation designed to sound inclusive.
You're reading my mind, Blair.
it basically just appeals to Christians.
Yes.
It applies to Christians.
Yes, absolutely. And I think I provide some pretty good and interesting evidence. I get into this very early on in the founding myth. It's a very new term. It's a contradiction in terms, in a way. And really, the idea of something being Judeo-Christian, we really saw it kind of begin to enter the mainstream after World War II, after the Nazi regime was taken down, after the Holocaust was exposed, when saying that something was, explicitly and exclusively Christian or Christian principles had a much more sort of ominous ring to it. And in order to make it sound more inclusive, Judeo got tacked on kind of as a fig leaf. And then the reason that's important to the book is because I wanted to dig deeper in this book than simply refuting the idea that we're a Christian nation. So the question that I asked is, did Judeo-Christian principles, whatever that phrase might actually mean, did Judeo-Christian principles positively influence the founding of the United States? And the answer to that is no, they didn't. And in fact, it's a good thing they didn't, because Judeo-Christian principles, again, whatever that means, and especially those that are central to the Christian nationalist identity, they're opposed to the principles on which the United States was built. And so the way I put it in the book is that the two systems differ and conflict to such a degree that, to put it bluntly, we can say that Christianity is un-American. So that's really the argument, the overall argument that I'm trying to make in the book, that these are two conflicting systems, that Christianity and America are two conflicting systems with irreconcilable differences, that America will never be a Christian nation because the moment it becomes a Christian nation, it will cease to be America.
Totally.
Amen to that.
Now, I know that, of course, the separation of church and state is considered heresy by the religious right, and that they claim that the American law is based on the Ten Commandments, as you said earlier. I mean, what I think the Sermon on the Mount and the Declaration of Independence are so radically different that it's if you can't see it, there's no hope for you. You know, that's my personal view. But what do you think of that, or what do you?
Well, the Declaration of Independence is an anti-biblical document, and this is something that I explain. I have a couple chapters on the Declaration in mm-hmm. the book. Mm-hmm. I go over the specific language that Christian nationalists latch on to, you know, their creator, the laws of nature and of nature's God, stuff like that. And the Ten Commandments is even easier, I think. Pretty clear that the Ten Commandments are grossly un-American. The first question we have to ask is, okay, well, which Ten Commandments do you think supposedly influenced the founding of America or American law and government? Because there are four sets in any Bible. Then different religions interpret them differently. They number them differently. And these may seem like small differences to us, but, you know, the difference between graven images and idols split the church, split Christendom in the 8th and 9th centuries in something called the Iconoclast Controversy. They had a civil war over that small difference. The difference between not being able to murder and not being able to kill is the difference between being able to protect yourself if a rapist breaks into your home at night or not. So there's really no such thing as a small religious difference, partly because you're assuming to understand and know an ultimate truth about the universe on the basis of faith alone, which is never a good recipe. But then if you actually get into the Ten Commandments themselves, I think you really see how un-American they are. I am the Lord your God, you shall have no other gods before me. Right? It'd be difficult to write a commandment that conflicted more with American law than that one. You are free to have as many gods as you want in this country, or no god at all, as I do. And no power, no secular power, stems from the idea of a god. I mean, our Constitution was the first to not draw its power from the supernatural, but from we the people. I mean, it goes on like this, right? You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain. Well, God damn it. You can curse and blaspheme all you want in this country because we have free speech. That conflicts with the First Amendment, not just the freedom of speech, but the free exercise of religion, too, because to have blasphemy would give one religion primacy under law and mean that other religions could not exercise the way they want. And it gets worse and worse and worse. You can't go worship other gods because I, the Lord, your God, am a jealous God, visiting the sins of the father to the children, to the third and fourth generation, right? So the yeah. Ten Commandments promise to punish innocent children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren, and great-great-grandchildren for the parents' crime of exercising their religious liberty, right? I mean, that is really hard to wrap your mind around if you are an American lawyer. I mean, there's so many things that are evil and wrong going on in that rule, right? It destroys religious liberty, which makes it exercising religious liberty a crime. And then instead of punishing somebody who's guilty of this non-crime, it punishes innocent children three and four generations down the line. I mean, that is just mind-bogglingly un-American and downright immoral and evil. And it's in the Ten Commandments.
Andrew, and this idea has been applied in Sweden until year 2000. If your parents were baptized, you belonged automatically as a child into the state church. So, but that's not anymore since 2000. But before that, you belong to the church if your parents have been baptized.
Nice thing to get away from. Even the rules, too. Let me just add this, too. Even the rules that people think of as having a good overlap with American law. Oh, well, you can't kill, you can't steal. There's really good reason to think that the way they are written in the Ten Commandments is much, much narrower. I mean, first of all, those are universal human principles that every successful society we know of has adopted on their own. Those are not Judeo-Christian principles. And to claim them for one religion or even, you know, Judeo-Christianity is the height of arrogance, in my opinion. But the biblical formulation of those rules, those universal rules, is considerably narrower. And then when you get to the 10th commandment, I mean, everything's out the window. You've got misogyny, you've got slavery, you've got thought crime, basically criminalizing the entire basis of the American capitalist system by saying you can't covet. I mean, where would American commercialism be without covetousness?
Let's go back to the wall of separation. Now, what did Jefferson actually mean by that? And let me quickly add that I think the wall protects both religion and the state. It's not meant to be breached.
No, for sure. I mean, look, the bottom line is that there is no such thing as the freedom of religion without a government that is free from religion. Genuine religious liberty requires a secular government. And that is part of what Jefferson and the rest of the founders meant when they were talking about keeping state and church separate. Of course, the phrase itself, the metaphor, it's great, such a great metaphor, comes from a letter that Jefferson wrote to the Danbury Baptists. And he talks about it in relationship to the whole First Amendment. So, I mean, there's this weird thing right now where the Supreme Court, in an effort to make the free exercise of religion more important than state-church separation, has divided the religion clauses of the First Amendment in half and turned one against the other. But if you go back and read that Jefferson letter to the Danbury Baptists, he recites the language of the First Amendment: Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. And he contemplates that language with solemn reverence, not just one of those clauses, but the whole thing. Because if you care about religious freedom, you have to have a government that is not telling you how to worship. And not just not forcing you how to worship, but not telling you how to worship. There are definite breaches that have existed in this country for a long time, and I try to point that out in the book. But really, you're absolutely right. Separation of state and church is as much to protect the government and the people as it is to protect churches and worshipers. It really is crucial. There is no such thing as the freedom of religion without a government that is free from religion.
Let me throw this in. I've heard recently, well, the last few years, people on the left or whoever it may be say that churches should be taxed. Mm-hmm. And my initial reaction was to recoil from that, because I think the unintended consequence of that is you're giving them even more latitude to speak, to interfere with the political realm if you do that. What are your thoughts on that?
I mean, I think that's certainly a concern. I think, you know, part of the modern Christian nationalist movement you can probably trace back to the government threatening in a way the tax exemption of certain religious institutions. Like if you look at the Bob Jones University case, I'll get into this a little bit in the newer book. Okay. You might be able to make an argument that some of the rise of the religious right and the moral majority, for instance, you might be able to trace that to some very specific threats. Not a blanket threat we should tax the churches, but a threat to specific churches for engaging in, for instance, discrimination. I will say I don't necessarily think there's a religious freedom issue with taxing the churches. The Supreme Court has said that there is no First Amendment immunity to taxes. Now, this Supreme Court, I'm sure, would say something different, but when not captured by Christian nationalists, the Supreme Court has been more measured. And right now, there is something called the Johnson Amendment, which prevents all 501c3s, all charities, including churches, from engaging in partisan politics, meaning you can't endorse a candidate for office. So if we tax churches, that would go away. One other thing too that's worth mentioning, and this is where I always try when people talk about taxing churches to refocus, is the bigger problem right now is that every charity in the United States has to file financial disclosures with the government, with the IRS. Mm. So for instance, the larger charities have to file what's called a Form 990. And that tracks every penny that comes in and every penny that goes out of the organization. But churches don't have to do that. We have no idea. They are financial and informational black holes. We have no idea what kind of money those churches take in or where that money goes. That not only does that make them ripe for fraud and abuse, which they experience at much higher levels, but it also makes them ripe for crime and for all kinds of awful politicking and dark money scams and schemes. But more importantly, tax exemption is a public trust, and that public trust requires transparency. So the thing that I always say is, instead of taxing the churches, first, let's find out how much money they have. Let's make them follow the same rules that every other charity and nonprofit in the country has to follow, and they file these financial disclosures with the government. That should be step one.
No, I hadn't thought of that.
That's interesting. That's a good point, because yes, we're talking about, as you say, Christian nationalism and Christianity, and maybe Judean also. But as I said, it's other religions out there also, and there, if you can't trace it at all, and that you have seen in Europe also, how it pops up like mosques and others, and then they try to trace it, where is it going? So we have had cases there in Sweden, for example, that is going directly to Qatar or something like that. So that's an interesting question that you bring up there.
We touched on this earlier. Can you delve a little bit into the fabrications surrounding one of my personal heroes, George Washington?
Yeah, I mean, there are a couple fabrications surrounding George Washington.
Just a couple?
Just a couple, really. The two that I kind of get into the most in the book are his first presidential inauguration, the idea that he added, "So help me God," to the words of the presidential oath that are actually explicitly written down in the Constitution. That did not happen. I am certain that did not happen. Not only is it against Washington's character to do such a thing, nobody commented on it at the time, and it would have been comment-worthy because those words do not appear in the Constitution. We can actually trace that myth, too, to Washington Irving. Sleepy Hollow and He of the Headless Horseman. It goes to him who, and you get a copy of the book and read it to be sure, but I think he was 5 years old at the time, and he claims to have overheard him, Washington, say this in the crowd. It's not a believable explanation, especially when no contemporaries who were standing right next to Washington recorded the event. And so that's one. And the other one that I really get into in the book is the idea that Washington knelt in the snow in prayer at Valley Forge. This is like a very popular American myth, very popular image. And on postage stamps, there is a stained glass image of this that hangs in the U.S. Capitol in the prayer room. Ronald Reagan was very moved by the image, and it didn't happen. It did not happen. We know this story comes from an inveterate liar who also happens to be a parson. Parson Mason Weems was very excited when Washington died because he knew he would be able to sell a lot of books. And that's what this was all about. And it didn't appear until this particular story didn't appear until like the 35th or somewhere around there edition of Weems's book, The Life of Washington. No contemporary reports, no real witnesses. I mean, it definitely didn't happen. And this is the same guy, Mason Weems is the same guy who gave us the myth about Washington chopping down the cherry tree and not being able to tell a lie about that. So this is this guy who, he's an itinerant preacher. He publishes these salacious religious pamphlets, including one about masturbation. I mean, this guy's just all about profit, not accuracy. He gives us the lie about Washington not being able to tell a lie, which is, I mean, you don't get more ironic than that, right? But Washington can't tell a lie after chopping down a cherry tree is an untrue story. So I think it was actually the 17th edition of his book that it was added. I mean, you're talking 30 years after the supposed event occurred. So yeah, I mean, it did not happen. And the idea too that Washington knelt in the snow in this ostentatious prayer is fundamentally not the case also. He was not a publicly pious man. He refused to take communion in church when he was dying. He was on his deathbed for a couple of days. And there was no religious figure ever summoned. Washington actively shunned public piety. So this did not happen either.
When I was growing up, although I, to my credit, if you will, I rejected religion at a fairly early age. I still had to go to church, but my parents did instill in me that religion is a personal, private matter and should not be publicly flaunted. I think it's disappearing. I mean, I think the nationalists their arrogance is exceedingly irritable.
There's a really sloppy debate that is happening in Christian nationalism and in the law around things like the public sphere and public life and living religion in public life and having religion in the public square. And it's sloppy because it conflates a lot of different things. So, for instance, the position of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, where I work, and the position that I think the Constitution takes, is that as a government official, you can't use the power of your public office to promote your personal religion. And as a private citizen, you can't use the machinery of the state to promote your personal religion. Right. So there's no problem with you kneeling in the public square in prayer. That's perfectly fine and legal. And I would defend your right to do that. But if you want to get on the loudspeaker attached to the government building that broadcasts over the public square, then you're using the machinery of the state to promote your personal religion. And we've got a problem because the government does not belong to you, the Christian. It belongs to we, the people, all the people. And this is something we see all the time. I mean, we see it at public school football games, right? If a player wants to say a prayer before they run out onto the field, they're perfectly free to do that. But again, you don't get to use the public address system to broadcast that prayer to everybody in the stadium. And for some reason, that finer point, it gets lost all the time. And it's deliberately conflated on the other side where they say, you know, we are being told that we have to go back into our homes and we can only exercise our religion in our homes and our churches. And that's not what the Constitution says. And nobody's really saying that. I mean, yeah, you can be as ostentatious about your prayer in public as you want. I mean, Jesus says in the Sermon on the Mount that you shouldn't do that. He says that hypocrites want to be seen praying in public. So if you want to be a hypocrite in Jesus' eyes, go for it. I don't care. I mean, your Savior cares. I don't. And the law doesn't. But if you're going to use the government to promote your personal religion, then we've got a problem. And then I'm going to step in, and then the Freedom From Religion Foundation is going to write you a letter and sue you if you don't listen.
Let's delve a little bit more into some of the chapter titles of your book, if we can.
Sure.
The parts, the Ten Commandments versus the Constitution. What is the threat display? What is that?
So the Ten Commandments section. So the book's really broken down into three basic parts. So part one is the founders, the Declaration of Independence, and our colonies. Because you've got to really get into that. Then you have the United States versus the Bible. So I'm really looking at biblical principles and comparing them to our founding principles in the United States. And the third part is the Ten Commandments versus the Constitution. And it's that third part that was actually the beginning of the book. So when I started to write this, I was initially envisioning it really just as a law review article. So a scholarly law review article that not a lot of people would read. And it started off that way because a Supreme Court opinion, I won't get into the nuts and bolts of it, where Justice Scalia basically says, well, of course, American law and government is based on the Ten Commandments. Everybody knows that. And I remember reading that and thinking, well, that can't be right. And the more it was just such a blithe assumption that I thought, you know, I'm going to start looking at this. And then I thought, wouldn't it be fun to compare the Ten Commandments to the Ten Amendments to the Bill of Rights? And then it kind of grew and grew from there. And I had a lot of supportive folks in my life telling me that it was bigger than a law review and I needed to go from there. And then Susan Jacoby, who some of your listeners might know, who's written a number of really just phenomenal books on free thought and religion, and Robert Greene Ingersoll.
Yes, she's great. Yeah,
she is. She kind of took me under her wing and said, "Look, you got to go big with this. This book is bigger than you are thinking. I'm going to introduce you to some agents. We're going to get you into one of the bigger publishing houses." And she agreed to write a foreword for the book, and really just really changed and gave a bigger view of what this book could be. So I'm eternally grateful to Susan for that. So anyway, to answer your question, I just want to set the scene for people a little bit. The 14th chapter of the book is called The Threat Display, the First Commandment. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. And I talk at the beginning of the chapter about how, you know, this is what you see in the animal kingdom, in Wild Kingdom, right? Gorillas, you know, rear up and they puff out their chests and they beat their chests to show off how strong they are. And this is exactly what the biblical God is doing in this first commandment. I mean, it just reeks of somebody saying, I'm strong, pay attention to me and don't disobey me. I kind of get into how specifically that idea is fundamentally and irreconcilably opposed to, for instance, the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, which guarantees religious freedom among other rights, and the freedom of thought more broadly.
I've mentioned this to you before, because this is, I think, the third time you've been on our show, which is really great, that I consider the Bible as the blueprint for authoritarianism. I mean, mm-hmm. and that right there, you know, what you just said about, you know, worship no God before me or other than me, that starts it off, I think. Mm-hmm. What about some of the other commandments compared to, as you say, the Bill of Rights? I don't see any corollary.
No. And what I used to say when I would travel around the country in the before times, when I was giving these book talks, is all of the Ten Commandments, all the commandments that we think of as the Ten Commandments. You know, we've been assuming that the Exodus 20 set is the Ten Commandments that people mean, but it's actually not called the Ten Commandments in the Bible. That honor goes to the set that's in Exodus 34, which ends, "Don't boil a kid in its mother's milk." But all of the Ten Commandments from either of those sets, all of them are un-American or would be either illegal or unconstitutional. For instance, if they were written into American law today, including the ones that people think of as "don't kill, don't murder," all that kind of stuff. Yes, even those. I'm not going to give away all those secrets. I think people need to buy a copy of the book or get it from the library. I really care about. Less about people buying and more about them actually reading it. Just don't burn it.
And as I could also say, you could also listen to the audiobook, and there is like 12 hours of information. I also started out and I said, I mean, for me, it's both encouraging what you're doing, but also a bit, as I said, American in spirit, a bit frightening. Mm-hmm. So it's an important issue, because when you said that it was like now maybe over 20% that says that we are not any believers in some way. And I often said that, like, compared Sweden with America, and I am an American in spirit, I said in Sweden it's like 90% that non-believers and 10% that are believers, but they believe it's the state making miracles. And so and in America, it's the vice versa. It's like the 80-20 rule, or 90% say they believe in something and 10% not, like that. But it's positive to see that it's increasing, and maybe, as you said, it could be a liability for this litmus test, for example, that you have to, if you're a Republican, you have to be against abortions and you have to say that you believe in God. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a positive sign there also. But now when you talk about the Supreme Court and how they try to, all the pressure groups, so to speak, mm-hmm. I'm getting a bit worried. So it's glad that they read your book. But have you thought about any campaigns to that every, as I said, in power should read this? Maybe they don't have to burn it, but, you know, read it and think about it.
Yeah, we did have a couple of very generous donors who wanted to help do that. So one of them paid to have every member of the Supreme Court sent a copy of the book. And one of them paid to have every member of Congress sent a copy of the book, which, you know, you're talking 500 plus books in that case. And that was done. It was really just a lovely thing to be an author and have somebody else believe in your book as much as you do and think that it is that important. That was really a touching moment for me personally in this kind of journey of writing these books. You know, I think a lot of people wonder, is it ever going to be read? Is it ever going to have an impact? And, you know, when I have people donating copies to every member of Congress and Christian nationalists burning it in effigy, you know, not in effigy, in reality, it's nice to be able to see that you're having an impact. And you know, I think too, just as bad as the court is right now, and it's worse than I've even communicated, I am hopeful overall about where the country is going because the demographics are shifting so rapidly. And that is going to play out in the political landscape, as I was trying to explain earlier. I mean,
sure.
They are, or before the pandemic, well, no, even during the pandemic, right? They were looking out in the pews, and instead of seeing young, smiling faces looking back at them, they were seeing white hair and bare wood. I mean, the demographics are not in their favor. And I think that is part of what you are seeing right now. They are raging against the dying of their privilege. And they're doing everything they can to codify that societal and demographic privilege that they had for so long into the law and into the Constitution because they know it's going away. And they're doing massive damage right now. They're doing massive damage. But I don't think it's to a point where we can't recover yet.
Oh, I think the pushback is alive and well, sure. Boy, this has been great, I tell you. I do break up the sort of negativity, but nonetheless, it has to be said, I do have one burning question I do want to ask.
Shoot.
How many basketballs does it take to fill the Grand Canyon?
it's a great question.
This was in your introduction, I think, or the
this. Yeah, this was. I think that was Dan.
Dan Barker. Abbott, yeah.
Yeah. So to be fair, okay. Here's the more technically pedantic question is how much dirt and rock would fill the Grand Canyon? How if you took that volume, how many basketballs would it fill, right? Because if you actually like put the balls in there, they don't meet perfectly on the edges, all that stuff. So ignore that for now. Why don't you guys take a guess?
Oh my. The basketballs are dirt and rock.
Well, the dirt and rock that would do the basketballs. So just pretend that the dirt and rock would go into the basketballs first. That would be our measure, and then we would dump it into the canyon. Okay, so how many would we need? Does that make sense?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Take a guess.
I would say millions. That's me. I don't know.
Okay, millions.
Martin.
Yeah, I have no clue. I don't know how big Grand Canyon is. Maybe I shouldn't, but I know about how big basketball is. But it sounds million sounds plenty of.
Okay,
is it so big?
It is so big.
It's, yes.
Yeah. It would be 118 trillion, wow. 200 billion. That's how big that hole is. It's
wow.
Huge. yeah. So I did that. I did that calculation back when I was a tour guide. Somebody calculated how many cubic miles of dirt or earth were missing, and I thought, well, that is just not a very useful number. So I just did a little math and put it into basketballs instead.
Well, I thought I kind of had to ask that question.
Yeah,
I thought it was funny and cute.
Yeah.
And but anyway, Andrew, we've really enjoyed having you on. We're eagerly anticipating your next book, which you say is coming out next year.
Coming out next year sometime. The manuscript is due in 153 days. I'm not counting or anything, nervously trying to finish. but yeah, I'm not exactly sure when next year it will be out, but yeah, probably summer or fall of 2022 would be my guess right now. So Weaponizing Religious Freedom.
As an ending note here, Andrew, when you were together with Margaret, how have you celebrated Thomas Paine Day, and any reflection on that?
I mean, it really just kind of an amazing, amazing guy. And Margaret has done such a remarkable job of promoting his legacy and celebrating his legacy, doing it for years, decades, really. Mm-hmm. And drawing together people from all over the secular movement and then beyond to raise up and help do this. And hopefully there's going to be an announcement soon on, I can't steal the thunder. Hopefully there'll be a big announcement soon, on the Thomas Paine front. I'm sure we'll be in touch when that happens.
Because, okay. It was very inspiring to watch, webinar, so to speak, and the live presentation, especially with the sculpture, I must say.
It's pretty remarkable. Yeah. Zenos' sculpture really is just, it's amazing.
Yeah, I was very impressed with the sculptor and what he was doing. It was very, very striking. So, yes. All right. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we've been talking today with Andrew Sedell, author of The Founding Myth, Why Christian Nationalism is Un-American. And Andrew, thanks for manning the foxhole with us today.
Oh, it was my pleasure, gentlemen. Thank you so much for having me over. Really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
It's our pleasure. Our pleasure. Thanks, Andrew.
Bye.
Bye-bye.